Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello, folks, and welcome to Good Growing with the Garden Guy, your host Tom Azure with Sister Sue. Welcome, Sue.
I'm so glad to be here.
And we have Gary Heilig.
I am here and ready.
Okay. Well, let's get going. We're going to talk about blueberries. We're going to talk about drought. We're going to talk about lawns. We have a full agenda today.
Yes, I hope we get to all of it.
Okay. Sue, would you lead us in a word of prayer?
Sure. Heavenly Father, thank you that we can get together and discuss the wonderful things that you have bestowed upon us by your creating them, that we can be thankful for, that we can enjoy in all of its ways, from the work to the eating to the beauty of the blossoms and everything that you have provided and are sustaining us through this drought. So help us to learn more and be able to appreciate you all the more as a creator. In your name, amen.
Amen. There's a lot to talk about drought, but let's talk about fun things like blueberries.
Yeah, we're going to start out with the blauberry.
Blauberry? Where does the quiz. Blauberry come
blau,
from?
Blau is blue in German.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, I don't know what blueberry is in German, though. But anyway, moving on. The first question is, what did North American indigenous peoples call blueberries?
That's a Sioux question.
I bet it's something like, small round thing goes in pemmican.
That's good, Sue, but no, it's wrong. It was called star fruit because of the five-pointed star shape at the bottom of the fruit, which is the flower
blossom end.
The blossom end, that's right.
Oh, that's clever. I like that.
Okay, the next question is a multiple choice. How many blueberries can you expect to get on a mature plant? 2,000? 4,000? 6,000? Or 8,000.
I could only hope even the 2,000.
I was thinking in pounds. I was thinking, I don't know, maybe 6 pounds or 8 pounds or something. I wasn't thinking so many about.
Well, in terms of production, a mature bush will give you about 14 to 16 pints. And I don't know how much a pint weighs, but we're talking about individual berries. And this is a mature high bush blueberry.
Now, is this before you eat while you're picking or after?
It's just production. I don't care where you put it.
We used to make jokes when we picked, you know, do they weigh you in and out on your U-pick?
No, they don't. But when we were out picking blueberries once, my little daughter, who was about 2 or 3 years old, ate a bunch of blueberries, which I always tell my wife, never let somebody eat something before they have a chance to wash it. But blueberries do a really good job of getting your bowels to move. So we had an interesting day. But anyway, the answer is, somebody want to guess before I tell you?
Well, let's say, I'm going to say, take the middle ground. Let's go with 4,000.
Tom, what do you think?
I'd have to take a middle ground of 4,000 also.
It's actually 6,000.
Oh, okay.
So,
we weren't ambitious enough, Tom.
Yeah. So the next one is, what are the five top blueberry producers in the world?
Okay, well, I think since they came from here and we grow a lot of them, I think we got to be in on that.
That's number one at 200,000 tons. Who do you think is next?
Canada.
Our neighbor. Yeah, our neighbor, because they got like the same climate type thing going on there.
British Columbia produces a lot of blueberries. And then who would you think would be after that one?
You know,
I'll give you a hint. They're all on this side of the world.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I bet it's like Peru or Chile or something.
South America.
Actually, Chile is number four. Peru is number five. You're missing one. Number three.
Oh, Mexico, because they're always growing things in the winter.
Very good, Sue. You're absolutely right.
So what is it? It seems so many different cultivars have come from different places in the world. How did we get so blessed with blueberries?
Well, they are indigenous to here, Tom.
They are indigenous to here. Now in Europe, they have something called a bilberry, which is very similar, but it's used for medicinal purposes as well as fresh eating. But it is similar to a blueberry. It's in the same genus. The next one is, what are the three major types of blueberries?
I know this. I do. I actually know this one, Tom, because I talked to the blueberry person when we were picking. There's high bush.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And then there's low bush. We picked some of those up at Nuevo State Park, though.
Right.
They have some there.
When you get up around Clare, you will find low bush blueberries growing. But the main blueberries that are all pretty much collected in the wild, those are low bush.
The low bush ones usually don't get about
6 to 8 inches high is about the most you'll see.
There's not very many, but we would pick enough to make blueberry pancakes.
Yeah, and they also tend to have a stronger flavor. The blueberries are smaller.
Oh, they're good. They're yummy.
Okay, there's one more type.
Then there's the bunny or something.
Right, rabbit eye.
Rabbit eye.
Those are blueberries that are found more in the south. So southwestern, southeastern United States and southern states. And they can get up to 6 feet tall like the high bush types.
Why are they called rabbit eye?
I don't know.
I just wondered because do they tolerate the heat more or something?
They do tolerate heat more. I don't know why they call them rabbit eye, but I'm going to find out and I'll bring it back next time.
Okay. Stay tuned.
All right, number five. What are the three top blueberry producing states in the U.S.?
Oh, I bet Washington's in on that. They're always trying to get ahead of us.
They're number one. Okay.
I knew it.
Now,
number two,
I was a little bit surprised that.
Yeah, well, there's a
possibility. I'll give you a hint. It's a southern state.
Really?
Florida or Carolina or something like that for the winter.
No. There's only a few more southern states. You want to keep guessing?
Georgia?
Georgia's number two. Hmm. And then who do you think is number three?
Michigan,
right. And Washington is like 96.1 million pounds produced. Georgia's 92. And Michigan is about 92 also. So they're pretty close.
I was going to say, we have an awful lot of blueberry farms. Well, we should be in there.
Yeah, we are. And now this is according to the World Atlas. Now, if you were to go on Google and find out what's the number one state, they'll have Maine down. But most likely what they're referring to there is low bush blueberries.
Yeah, they're tiny and there's not very many on there, but they are pretty good. And they're just the size to put in your waffles or your pancakes.
Yeah, because some of the blueberries, especially that are under irrigation, get so large. Some of them will get almost as large as a nickel. And so when you're making blueberry muffins, you just put one in the middle.
So when you have them in mixes and the dried blueberries seem to be smaller.
Those are the low bush blueberries.
I was wondering, yeah.
And then, like I said, they have a very intense flavor compared to the others. Now, where is the origin of blueberries? Europe, China, U.S., Iran?
Well, we already said the U.S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I still had the questions I wanted to ask.
We're the origin of cranberries, too, so.
Yeah, we are. Mm-hmm. Okay, the next one's a little bit more difficult, I think. In 2021, the United States exported 83.6 million pounds of fresh blueberries, both cultivated and wild, to Canada. Who is the number two importer of American berries? And these are in the frozen form. I will give you a hint. It is an Asian country.
China again?
No.
Japan.
Not this time. No.
One more. Korea.
South Korea. I didn't know that. That's pretty impressive.
Is it because we were over there and we liked our blueberries, so we brought them with us when we were there during the Korean War or something?
It's possible, or either Koreans coming over here and discovering them and sending them back, because that's what a lot of the European explorers did when they went to foreign countries. They'd find something and then they take it back. Classic example is when we think of Italian food, what vegetable do we think about?
Tomatoes,
right. But they didn't know of tomatoes until they were brought back from the New World.
Yeah, that's true.
And
peppers either, I think.
And they went to town. Yeah, peppers too. They went to town when they got a hold of tomatoes. We were a little bit more reluctant to accept them, but okay. So the next question is number 7. What fruit? And when I talk about fruit, I'm not just talking about oranges and strawberries and those things, but a fruit is anything that results from pollination. So that include tomatoes and peppers and things of that sort. So what fruit has the most antioxidants?
I thought.
Well,
of
let's
all.
See. Maybe because we're talking about blueberries.
Very good deductive reasoning. You know, you'd be surprised how many people wouldn't even latch onto that. But yeah, it is now wild, fresh, low bush blueberries. And they have about 10 times the recommended levels of antioxidants based on the USDA. And they have a lot more than the high bush blueberries.
Mm-hmm.
But something you need to know, if you bake them in a pie, it does destroy some of those antioxidants. And that'll come back in a little bit. So This question is, who eats the most blueberries in the world?
Us.
Top four. Yep.
Top four.
No, actually the United States is number 2.
Really? Somebody eats more than us? What is it, China? Because there's so many Chinese peoples?
Remember, we're talking per capita.
Oh.
So per person.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Think about
we're number 2. Oh,
think
Canada.
About Canada. Right. Canada eats between 3 and 4 kilograms, and I didn't bother to convert that to pounds, but a kilogram is 2.2 pounds. And the United States is number 2 at 1.5 to 1.8 kilograms. The number 3 is Europe at 0.5 to 0.6 kilograms. So they don't eat nearly as many as the United States and Canada. And then China's 4th with 0.2 to 0.5 or 0.4 kilograms.
Hmm.
Interesting. I suspect that over time, that's going to go up. And I think those are 2017 figures.
Seems like China's always in there when we do these quizzes. Like, yeah, China.
Well, they're such a big country.
And there's so many people there, I guess.
Yeah. All righty. The next one, number 9. True or false? The consumption, and I'll tell you, my wife got this one wrong. The consumption of blueberries has been linked to health benefits, including a reduced risk of cancer, increased blood insulin response, a reversal in age-related memory loss, and lowering of blood pressure. Now, remember, it says consumption of blueberries has been linked to health benefits, including a reduced risk of cancer, et cetera, et cetera. True or false?
I'm going to say true.
Okay, what do you say, Tom?
Some of them are true, but boy, that make it the miracle fruit.
It would, wouldn't it?
Yes.
True or false? Make a decision.
True.
Well, I'm just in a good mood. Why don't we say true?
You would be right.
Oh, good.
My wife got stumped up and she said, nah, can't help lower blood pressure. And it is true.
Good.
All right, the last question is, in what form of blueberries do you get the most antioxidants? Fresh, dried, or frozen?
I'm thinking fresh.
My mommy always told me fresh is better. So.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm going to change it frozen because they freeze them the same day and they don't sit on the shelf in your produce department. So I'm going to say frozen.
Okay. You know what the answer is? There's practically no difference. So as long as you don't heat them too much, because my wife was fussing at this question because she said, well, when you dry blueberries, they're heated. Well, we have a food dryer at home, and yes, it does heat them. But blueberries can also be dried like they do raisins in the sun. And that's the level of heat is so low that it doesn't have a significant effect on the antioxidants. So if you don't eat blueberries, antioxidants, if you remember when we talked about them before, they can help you in terms of fighting cancer in the sense of delaying the onset of cancer. And we talked about antioxidants once before. It gets a little bit complicated, but they do a lot of good things. There's a process called oxidation in your blood, and they help to reverse that somewhat. I don't want to go through it all again, but they're definitely something worth eating. And if you've never had dried blueberries, what I call blueberry raisins, they're really good on your cereal and in cookies. They're just great.
Well, it's more concentrated flavor, just like you talked about the low bush blueberries.
Right. And you really can't, if you eat a high bush blueberry, it's kind of hard to determine what is the flavor like, because it's not like anything else. But when you eat a dried one or a concentrated one, then you recognize a very distinct flavor that no other fruit has. Mm-hmm. So I never even tasted a blueberry until I was an adult.
Really?
Yeah, it just wasn't in our menu. And I love dried blueberries. I just eat them by the handfuls.
So I haven't tried that, but they sound good, because I like just blueberries so good.
Well, they're just great on cereal because they're just packed with flavor. So you should try them.
I don't know. I haven't been Trader Joe's. I'll get me some.
All right. So that's the quiz for this week.
Okay, Gary. We're just a little bit before the break, but give us a little inkling on what we're going to talk about. We have had drought on drought. I don't know where you are. Sue talks about, when I talk with her, very, very little rain. We've had some hit here in Grand up in Cadillac, but there's been long stretches in between. It's been kind of hard on a lot of things. What's in your part of the state?
Well, you can really tell the status of water in Michigan by what shape your lawn is in. And normally cool season grasses will go dormant during the summer, but the last few years they were green year round because we were getting plenty of moisture. This year, if you planted young trees and you weren't watering your lawn, it's already straw colored. So the water level in the soil is really low right now. And that can have an effect on how fast things will grow. Like if you're not watering your garden, plants will be stunted. And I have some edible pea pods. They were producing pea pods and the plants were only like 5 inches high, which normally they'd be running up the fence that we have at this point. So drought can make a big difference. And one of the things we're going to talk about is irrigation and ways to save moisture in the soil.
Yeah, a very relevant topic this summer. Well, folks, hold on, and we'll be back after this break. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Tom Majeure, Sue Majeure, and Gary Heidler.
Hi, folks. Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, "Surely I am coming quickly." We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087 on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hello, folks. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Tom Majeure, and Sue Majeure. We talked about blueberries, and it's kind of the fun quiz, and now we're kind of getting down to the serious business of drought. Gary, how do we handle drought?
Well, one of the things that I did is I like this Weather Channel. It's called Ryan Hall.
Okay.
It's actually called Ryan Hall, y'all. Okay. And he's a meteorologist, and he does long-term forecasting and all kinds of things. Really good Weather Channel that you can watch on YouTube. And one of the things that Ryan was saying is that because we were getting an El Nino out in the Pacific, that this part of the country – was going to experience a warmer and drier summer, which so far has been right on the money.
Correct.
And so one of the things that we did as we were planting our garden, we put down irrigation drip hoses immediately. So, and we can individually water certain rows. And I have one of those watering dispensers where you have it. It's on a tripod, and it's like a general lawn sprinkler where it'll wet everything. Mm-hmm. But when you do that, you also wet in between the rows, and there are literally billions of weed seeds in there. So if you target your water, then you can decrease your work a lot, especially if you're not getting rain. So what we do is we use drip hoses, and I like the flat ones better than the round ones that are made of recycled rubber, because the recycled rubber ones tend to spring leaks pretty quickly, and you're always repairing hoses. But the ones that are flatter, that seem like more of a cloth, and when the water goes through it, they become round. They seem to last longer in terms of not having to repair those hoses. So we put those down right away, and then we will mulch. For instance, if it's a warm season crop, we'll put on either side of a black landscape fabric. And if it's a cool season crop, like cabbage or broccoli or lettuce or spinach or those types of things, then we will put straw around it, because the straw, being a light color, will reflect sunlight and keep the soil cooler. So I'm giving the plants what they need in terms of root temperatures, warm or cool. And then we have the irrigation tape right down that row, and we're only watering right there. And so then we figure out how long does it take that hose to water down to about 4 inches. And that's how we water. We'll give it a good deep watering, and then we hold off for a while. And then we'll come back and check a few days later to see how it is. And that is the best way to keep the weeds down and also provide water for the plants. And at the same time, because you're not spraying like somebody that goes out, what I call horticulture therapy with a hose. Yeah. My father was really good at that. He would, in the evening, he would go out, hose in hand, and give everybody a shower. And there is a certain satisfaction in doing that. You're giving your babies a bath. But when you're doing that in the evening, the leaves stay wet longer, and that's how you get disease, because fungal spores are in the air, or they'll start releasing spores from the soil onto the lower leaves. And if it's wet, you'll start to get disease. But when you have drip irrigation and it's working like it's supposed to, the water's always going down, leaves stay dry, and then it takes much longer to get disease, because it depends on the water that's falling in rain, as opposed to you being out there with a hose or something like that. So also, what I like to do is water, if it's possible, during the heat of the day. And with drip irrigation, what that does is reduce the amount of stress on the plants. And if you have plants that tend to bolt, for instance, spinach will bolt. You can also have bolting from, or what's called buttoning on cauliflower, where it'll produce a little tiny head, but the head never gets big. When the plants are stressed, that's when they're more likely to get this bolting problem. So if you're watering during the early morning hours or when the sun is really hot, then that's okay. But if you're overhead watering, that's when you want to water anyway, so that you have time for those plants to dry off before sundown, which of course will decrease your chances of getting disease when you do that.
So I'm curious, is it better to water once a day or twice a day?
That really depends. If you're doing a deep watering, once a day is usually sufficient. But if you're on a lighter textured sandy soil, and you have very small plants out there that are just trying to get established, then you may have to water more than once in the day, especially if it's hot and windy. So you have to consider all of those different things. But if it's a well-established plant and you're watering deeply, once a day or once every 2 to 3 days is sufficient, but you need to check. And especially if you have some kind of soil covering like a mulch, then you won't have to water frequently, because water will evaporate when the sun is beating on bare soil. And when that surface water evaporates, then water that's down deeper will tend to move upward in the soil profile through something called capillary action. And capillary action is like if you take a paper towel and you dab up water, and what happens is the water moves from the wet area to the dry area very quickly, and that's what capillary action is like. So if you have very young plants, then you're going to have to watch them more closely. Once they're established, they're going to do much better. And if you are using irrigation, drip irrigation, it doesn't really matter if you water in the morning or water in the evening. But if you're interested in reducing stress, then that mid-afternoon is okay.
Sounds good. I think I may change after listening to this, go from twice a day to once a day with my mature plants.
Yeah, and for somebody that has water, like using a lawn sprinkler, for instance, to water, you'll notice that as soon as the surface of the ground starts to heat up, you start getting more wind action. And so if you have a windy day, if you're using a lawn sprinkler, the water is not going to be dispersed evenly. So that's why it's better to water really early in the morning before the wind actually starts to build up. And the leaves are kind of wet anyway if you had a dew from the previous night. So take those things into consideration. Now, also in the garden, it's still time to plant. And what I will be doing is I'll be starting more broccoli plants, cauliflower, spinach, lettuce, radishes, all of those things. Many of them, especially the leafy greens, can be started at numerous times during the course of the season, and you can continue to get things off of your garden, as opposed to, say, planting a whole row of spinach and not knowing what you're going to do with it, and it ends up bolting because you've eaten so much spinach you don't even want to water it anymore.
That's right.
And so also, usually after 6 to 8 weeks that you put down your first fertilization in your garden, then it's time for your final one. And in previous lessons, I've talked about you put down all of your nitrogen required in your garden before you plant, usually about 7 to 10 days before you plant, and you put up 2/3 of the phosphorus and potassium. If you were using just, say, a balanced fertilizer like a 10-10-10 or a 12-12-12, the full amount that you're going to need for the garden, 2/3 of it will go down right before you plant. And then that last third is 6 to 8 weeks later, which is about mid-July. So if you haven't done that by mid-July, you might want to get to it. Normally, we do what's called side dressing, mm-hmm. where you're putting it along the row, either watering it in or you are working it in lightly with a hoe. And you want that fertilizer about 2 inches from the base of the plant. Now, if you don't have a big garden, you want to put it in a circle around your plants, that's fine. Just don't put it right at the base of the plant. That could cause some problems.
So,
So is this something that we need to ask him about the pumpkins, Tom?
Yeah, the pumpkins were kind of in the vine garden. I have a weed block, and they haven't done too good so far this year.
Well, if you were like us, when we were in June, we had a cold period where we actually got down to the 40s at night, and warm season crops don't like that at all. So they were kind of just sitting there. Now that it's warmed up, they should be perking up pretty quickly. Now, do you have a lot of pumpkins or just a few or what?
Well, I was hoping for more. I feel like maybe 8 or 12.
They haven't started vining yet, have they?
No.
Okay.
They're just
because they usually start vining in
6 to 8 inches.
Yeah, they usually start vining during July. But if the plants are still small and you want them to grow faster, just cut out a section of landscape fabric, maybe a 2-foot by 2-foot section, and put a slit in it and put it over the plant like you're putting a shirt on, mm-hmm. and then either cover the edges with some soil or either take some landscape fabric clips and just push it in the ground. That'll keep the soil warm and they'll take off. They really like that warm soil.
Okay. Is fertilizer important with these also?
Yeah, you should fertilize them just like the rest of the garden, what we just talked about.
Okay.
Now, when we had planted our melons and squash, we hit that cold spot and they were just sitting there. They weren't doing anything. Actually, one or two hills actually died. They just didn't like the weather. But the others are now starting to pick up because they're now moving into the type of the year that they like, the time of the year that they like, where the soils are really warm. And that's why they call them warm season crops. They just take off.
What about corn? I've heard the farmers talk about the corn didn't start very early because of the cold and
lack of moisture.
So is it going to catch up?
Yeah, corn can grow very quickly, especially after a rain that we're experiencing right now. And I grew some corn as transplants this year.
Okay.
And they did not like being transplanted because they were like, oh, maybe 6 inches tall. And I was wondering if they were going to make it. But I kept watering and giving them a liquid fertilizer. Now they've taken off. And we normally like to see corn up to about your knees by the 4th of July. Yeah, you've heard that old standard thing. And it just gives you an idea that you're going to get corn about the same time that you normally should, which is usually in August when you start getting your sweet corn.
And what about popcorn? Because his is popcorn.
Same thing. I mean, what you want to do is have enough time for that ear to form and to fill out completely. And so the reason why they say knee-high by the 4th of July is it gives you an idea whether or not you're behind or you're ahead of the game. And the corn in our area will be that size by the 4th. This rain will cause it to really take off. So I'm not too worried about the corn right now. For a while, I was getting a little concerned because the leaves were starting to roll up in a lot of the fields, which indicated they just didn't have enough moisture, and they were a little stunted, but they'll recover from that.
What about green?
Oh, here's a good question for you, Gary. For those of us who love the sweet corn and we plant that, you can kind of tell when it's ready. But for those of us who have not tried popcorn before, we were inspired by your last show with the corn quiz. And so a friend was like excited about this glass gem corn. And Tom has kindly planted some for her. But how do you know when it's ready to harvest? Because it's not, it has to be hard, right? It's not like sweet corn. You pick it when it's, you know.
Yeah. Normally, any type of Indian corn, people just leave it on the plant until it starts to dry a little bit. Same thing with popcorn, because popcorn has to get down to, I think, about 3% moisture in order for it to pop properly. So those are allowed to stay on longer than, say, sweet corn, because sweet corn, Americans like it when the inside of the kernel is still kind of milky. Uh-huh. Eastern Europeans like it when it starts to get a little more firm, and then it gets really starchy if you leave it on there too long, and it's not real enjoyable trying to eat it. But popcorn and Indian corn, we leave that on longer, so it dries down some, because a lot of people want it for its appearance. Although there is a particular Indian corn that was an All-America selection that was edible. It looked like a classic Indian corn, but it was an edible sweet corn.
Interesting.
So that one you would pick. That one you would pick like any sweet corn.
Because we were just thinking that maybe popcorn had to be left on the stalk till it was like October or something. You know?
Yeah, field corn is left to dry down partially on the stalk too, because if it's picked too soon, it has to be dried artificially in the bins, which is expensive because you have to use electricity and gas. But yeah, it's left out there to dry. And then when, usually in Michigan, just before we start to get snow, or when it really gets cold and you can tell that the corn is completely dead, then you can go out and harvest it.
This ought to be interesting, because the pictures sure looked like, well, I can see why they call it glass gem corn, because it looks kind of like semi-precious gems.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get some pictures of Tom's corn. But if, especially corn too, really responds to nitrogen. So if you haven't put on that mid-July fertilization, then you might want to get that done too.
Sounds good. What about the green peppers? I noticed we're right here towards the end of June when we're recording this program, and notice the peppers are starting to come out.
Produce flowers?
No, actually, I saw a few peppers themselves.
Yeah, both my peppers and other peppers that have been drier they get stressed. And what a plant does when it gets stressed is it wants to reproduce. Now, it's not a sentient being, but that's how it works. The whole point of producing a fruit is for reproduction. So a plant that's stressed will tend to set heavy seeds or heavy fruits, and it'll set them earlier. A classic example of that is when we have a drought year, like this year has been so far. If that continues, you can look forward to all your maple trees producing a lot of seeds next year, because that's how the tree will respond. Mm-hmm. And so the peppers have already started producing flowers when they're still small. Some of mine were less than a foot tall when they started making flowers. But what I do is I want a big vegetative plant, so I would just pinch those flowers off and delay producing the fruit, because if it's on a small plant, you're going to get small fruit. Mm. When it goes from the vegetative stage, which is building up the plant itself, to the reproductive stage, then the energy, the majority of it, is going into the producing the fruit at the expense of more vegetative growth. So if you have a small plant, you're going to have a small crop. And that's also the reason why we tell people that if you plant strawberries, that up until July 1st, you take off any blossoms so that it won't start producing fruit too soon before it's had a chance to run and spread and build up a plant that will be able to support a larger crop the following year.
Sounds good.
So what about this bolting? You're saying that dry weather causes things to bolt. I can remember having some lettuce that bolted in the garden. Boy, was that awful.
Yeah, and lettuce, if it doesn't get sufficient moisture, tends to be more bitter. So the best way to prevent bolting would be irrigation when it's drought, and mulching so that you hold on to the moisture you have. And what will happen with tomatoes, for instance, if we have very dry periods and then you once in a while water, that will cause blossom end rot, which is actually a calcium deficiency. And what happens in the plant with blossom end rot is certain nutrients are mobile in the plant. In other words, they can be moved from one place to another. So if a plant needs a nutrient and it's not getting enough from the soil and it's a mobile nutrient, the plant will move that nutrient to the growing point. And that's what happens with blossom end rot. Calcium is taken from the fruit to go to other growing parts of the plant, which causes a rotting on the base of the fruit. So, and that happens more often too when you have highly fluctuating soil moisture levels, like it gets very dry and then gets wet. And you have to remember, plants pick up nutrients in water. So they are ions dissolved in water. So if there's very little water available, then you have a problem.
Well, we're going to have to continue this conversation after the break. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button, or call 231-468-2087. We thank you, and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
Well, folks, we're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Tom Majeur, and Sue Majeur. We talked about drought last section, and this time we're going to talk about vermin. Woodchucks and more. I don't care for them. Do you, Gary?
Well, we have a fence around our garden, and I had noticed there was some feeding on my cabbage. And then I went outside the other day. I just looked out the deck door because I could see the garden. And here's this little woodchuck. He wasn't a full-grown, thank goodness. He was only about maybe 14, 16 inches. And he was going up and down the roads looking for what he wanted to eat. And I don't shoot varmints anymore. So I call my two guard dogs, a 7-pound toy poodle and a 12-pound toy poodle. And I said, girls, I have something for you. And by the time they got off there, the varmint had gotten out. But he had been feeding on my cabbage. And I don't mind woodchucks, but I like them on the outside of the garden because they can do a lot of damage in a very short period of time. Now,
bunnies.
Bunnies I can keep out, but the woodchuck, he can be pretty determined. But I had a friend, I call him Mountain Man Dan. He worked at the extension with me. He was an ag agent, and he had a fun way of dealing with him. He would shoot him and then invite somebody over and serve the little creature to him. And I said, oh, man.
Oh.
But his wife was a good cook, and people loved it. But anyway, not something I want to eat. But what I do is I find where their hole is, and usually they will have a hole in an area like under shrubs, behind buildings, in fairly protected places. And they usually have at least 2 to 3 holes that they're going in and out. I'll wait for a rainy day or a cooler day or at night, and you can buy these little gas cartridges. They look like little mini sticks of dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
And I will light those. It basically is sodium nitrate, carbon, and sulfur, which is like gunpowder, only they just substitute potassium nitrate with sodium nitrate. And what it does is produce carbon monoxide. And you throw them down the holes, cover the holes, and then he's not coming out.
Well, I put one of those down underneath my woodshed, and I was working my woodshed, and I had to leave.
Yeah, you're supposed to cover all the exit holes and put soil on top so that the gas won't get out.
Yeah, apparently there was some undetected.
Yeah, well, if you find, if you see gas coming up, then just get some soil and pour it over that area. But it's a very effective way to get rid of them. I'd rather not have to harm them, but sometimes you just don't have much choice. I'm at the point now where I would rather build fences, but these guys are not stupid. What you basically have to do if you have a fence is you might want to put around your fence chicken wire that goes up against the fence and then goes out away from the fence so that if he starts to dig, he'll run into that fence. But even then, sometimes it will go out even further, go down, go under that, then under the other fence and come up into your garden. They're not stupid. They're a bit of a challenge.
I understand.
And they're persistent, too.
Yeah.
I understood that you went vertically down, but I didn't think about going horizontally. Is there a ratio of 4 inches down and then out horizontally?
I mean, if you're using, say, something like chicken wire at the base so that he won't come right at the base of your fence, I'd want about 4 inches up there. So you're going to bend the chicken wire out. And then I would like to have at least 18 to 24 inches out. And you may have to use landscape ties so that that fence is really flat to the ground so that if you're mowing with your mower blades up high, you could go right over that area and it won't harm the blades or pull up your fence.
Do you lay it on the surface or does it have to be below?
It's laid on the surface.
Okay.
Yeah, if you get it right flat to the ground with the pins, then you can just lay it on the surface. You won't have to go down.
I thought you had to bury it and such.
No, you don't have to. I mean, if you were going to bury something, if you did a vertical fence below ground 3 feet, you probably would be pretty successful. But they could still go down lower than that if they want to.
Sure. Now, my experience was last week I walked in and saw a bunny inside my hoop house, and I knew that may come to that day one day, but...
Do you know how he got in?
Not necessarily. I don't know.
But he was certainly making a determined inroads on the beet greens.
Well, the sides were up, and the door was open, so that it didn't look like he had burrowed.
Yeah, but they don't need to burrow under things. Rabbits can scoot under a fairly low clearance area. If you have, say, 2 to 3 inches clearance, they'll scoot right under that easily.
Mm.
And it depends on how big the rabbit is, too, because rabbits are on their own when they're quite young. So they a smaller one can scoot under something that might only be 1 to 2 inches.
So I got out the chicken netting, the poultry netting, and put it up the side and mm-hmm. ran it right down to the surface. It didn't run it horizontally outside, but maybe if it continues, I'll...
Yeah.
Tom scared him good and plenty before he left, though.
Now, I was talking to a person the other day that was complaining that the moles had eaten all their seed corn.
They don't eat seed, do they? I thought they were insects and worms.
They primarily eat insects. They'll eat slugs and they eat earthworms a lot. They'll even eat spiders and some other things. But what people don't understand is that when a mole makes a hole, anybody can use it. So you might see a shrew down there, which a shrew would actually go after the mole. But what is responsible for the damage on the seeds are field mice or even a chipmunk. Yeah, a chipmunk will go in the mole holes. It's quite easily a ground squirrel could get in there, some of the smaller ground squirrels. And so they will go and eat the seed, and guess who gets blamed?
The poor mole.
The poor mole. And he had nothing to do with it.
He's actually probably doing a good job.
Yeah, they eat very little vegetable matter. They will eat some, but they're not going to go down the row and eat your seeds. And the reason why you see the mole hole there is many times as people put seeds down, in order to get the seeds to come up, what are they doing? They're watering the row. Mm-hmm. When they water the row, that attracts earthworms. And when the earthworms are attracted, that attracts the moles. So they go through there looking for food. But other things will go through there, and they'll find the seed and eat it.
Let's move on to snakes.
Okay. People ask me about what do I need to do to get rid of snakes in your garden. I tell them absolutely nothing. Most likely, the only snake you're going to find in your garden is a garden snake or a ribbon snake. And they're absolutely harmless. And so they'll get under things like I had a compost pile in a corner of my garden, and they would go in there because it was warm, especially early in the spring. Or we had left some landscape fabric from the previous year piled up in a corner. And again, it's black, it's warm. So you'll find snakes under there because they're cold, blooded animals. But they don't cause any problems at all. Now, they won't necessarily help your garden that much. They'll eat some small creatures, but nothing that would help you in terms of the things that get on your plants. So I just see them running around every now and then. Once in a while, you might see a milk snake, but it's rare that you're going to see much else than that. And so I just leave them alone. And my daughter, Leanne, used to love to play with the snakes when she would find some. And we would just tell her, Leanne, put the snakes down.
Especially the garter snakes. When they're frightened, they'll let out this like stuff on your hands, and yeah. It stinks. Oh,
yeah, they don't have much of the defense. And even when they bite you, I say, really? You don't even have teeth. So they're just not a problem. And I think they're kind of cute running around trying to act bigger than they actually are.
Let's talk about disease pressure.
Well, wait, one more question on the animals.
Uh-huh.
Toads are good for your garden, aren't they?
Yeah, they eat various types of insects, and I leave toads alone in the garden. I really like them, and there's a whole biology going on in your garden, and toads are really fun. So they eat flies and various other things that they find around, but they're nothing to be concerned about in the garden, especially if you're using organic mulches like straw. You'll be more likely to find things like slugs and toads and earthworms and various things close to the surface.
Okay, disease pressure on plants.
Disease pressure right now is quite low because in the morning when you go out, there's hardly any dew at all. And we've not had much rain. And what I try to get people to understand is the spores are like seeds, and they can be on the surface of the ground, or they may be blown in the air, depending on what disease it is. And so they land on a leaf, and when they get free moisture, then they can germinate and infect the leaf. That's not been happening much. So unless you're watering in some way, disease pressure has been very low. If you have fruit trees, for instance, apples, we talked about apple maggot in the past. Well, in order for apple maggot to show up, it usually starts emerging late June. But because of the lack of rain, they're not going to be out. So we need about a half inch of rain in order for them to start to emerge. And then it'll be about a week to 10 days before they actually start to damage your apples. So even the pressure with certain insects that may be dependent to, based on rain, like the maggots are, you're not going to see much pressure right away. But it doesn't mean you won't see them at all this season. If, say, for instance, we didn't get good rain until the end of July, you can expect in a few days they'll start coming out and you'll get much later season damage than you normally would. So you still have to keep that in mind.
Well, you brought up fruit care with the disease pressure. Anything else that we should be working on in July?
Well, as we start to get... say summer raspberries, which come out right after the strawberries. I've talked about this before, the fruit fly. It's the spotted wing Drosophila. And as the July raspberries ripen, or if you have day neutral strawberries, those will continually have to be sprayed. Otherwise, you'll have maggots in the fruit. Also, peaches will be ready later in August, but those will have to be sprayed as you get closer to being ripe too, because it will bother them also. Grapes, you don't have to worry about so much until they start to ripen, but that is a concern also. Cherries, blueberries. There are some blueberries that will ripen later July, and you want to be sure that you're treating for that problem. Cherries will be ready in July, so there are other maggots too that will get in the cherries if you're not treating them, but they also need to have that rain in order for those maggots to, or I should say the flies, emerge and start laying eggs.
Let's we've touched on the lawn with drought. Anything else that we need to be thinking about on our lawns?
Well, one thing I tell people is if you're not irrigating, there's no need to fertilize, because dormant lawns don't grow and they don't need fertilizer. But I remember the year 1988 when we had lawns starting to go dormant like this. But when you go from dormant to dead, they don't look any different. So there's a point where it gets so dry that the lawn will just die out. And you'll know that as you go out there once it's dead and it starts to decompose, it won't have roots anymore and you can just start pulling up your lawn. So if you aren't into irrigating, but we still continue to have dry weather and we don't get any rain, you may just want to go out and give them a watering maybe once every 2 weeks, once every 3 weeks, just so the lawn doesn't die. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have one of those really nice lawns, and for people who might be in a, say, a residential area with an HOA, that's a homeowners association, they're going to make you water your lawn. Many of them will say, and my son's one in Kalamazoo, and they left a little ticket on his door, please water your lawn, and please cut it too. So they could be very specific as to what is acceptable. If you have dead shrubs, they have to be taken out and replanted and all those sorts of things. So if you don't want your lawn to die, but you don't want to spend the money on irrigating it, you should at least irrigate it once every 3 weeks or so, so it won't die. Now, if you do want to get it green again, don't fertilize. Start out with water, and water at least once or twice a week. And as it starts to green up again, give like a half application of fertilizer, especially nitrogen, which will start to green it up again. And another thing, once it's growing, you can get a deeper green by applying iron. Mm. And you can buy iron at the garden center, but you want to go real light on that, because the more iron you use, the darker your lawn gets, and it can get a little strange looking. And if you don't apply it properly and evenly, you'll get dark patches and light green patches. So, but there are ways to get it back to green. But just remember that naturally, because we have cool season grasses, they look their best in the spring and in the fall. And unless you put the artificial inputs in to keep it growing during the summer, it will naturally go dormant.
Do we need to talk about grubs in our remaining moments?
Well, the reason why I put that in there is because in July, is the adults are out right now, and they're laying eggs into the soil in July. And so that's when you put down things like Merit, or what's called imidacloprid, and that kills them. But that only works for a while. Once they become more mature, then you have to switch over to a different material. Now, some people like to do organic things, and They like to use things like grub attack, for instance. Just remember that grub attack works primarily on the beetles of, or the larvae of Japanese beetles. And in a dry year, your primary grubs will be European chafers, not Japanese beetles. The only exception to that would be in subdivisions where everybody's watering their lawn on a regular basis. In those areas, you can have higher populations of Japanese beetles. And in that case, then making applications of something like grub attack could be useful.
Okay, just in our last remaining minute, talk about lawn equipment maintenance.
Well, I was going to talk about is in the spring, a lot of people that have rototillers don't think about maintenance for those rototillers. But not only do you have to change the oils in those things, but every now and then you have to change spark plugs. You should, before you store it for the year, you should take as much gas out of it as you can, then run the motor till it completely runs out. And the reason we do that is we don't want varnish to build up in the system, and that can cause problems with the injectors. Also, if you've never changed your spark plug, if you're having any problem with your engine, you might want to do that. There are various grease points that you need to grease, which a lot of people don't do. Check the quality of the tines when they start to get sharp. That's the time of the year to get some new tines and put those on. And also, there is what we call a transmission oil that will need to be changed. And it doesn't have to be changed that often, but for instance, if you've had a tiller that for 10 years or so, and you've never changed it, and you've never checked the level, you really should check the level on those to see where it is. It doesn't get dirty, but after 15 years or so, you certainly should be changing it.
Absolutely.
What will happen is the seals around the wheels can start to leak, and you'll get a lower level of that gear oil. And so if you have lower levels, that will wreck that transmission.
Increase the wear.
Right, increases the wear. So depending on what kind of tiller you have, you want to make sure you put the right gear oil in there. And I have a Troy-Bilt, and I had some trouble finding the gear oil that it required. I had to order it online.
Well, thank you so much, Gary. Another edition of Good Growing with the Garden Guy. We'll see you again next month. Well, for Sue and Tom and Gary, until next time, bye now.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.